Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock musicians.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
This is Redbeard, and today we go in the studio with the best of Eric Johnson in Europe Live.
Definitely when you go to that more of that Zen place where you're kind of letting go and that bigger than yourself thing is happening, and then you're just caught in that, you're just surfing that wave, you know. It's cool. I actually am a big fan of surfing because I see a real correlation with kind of the way I kind of look at music.
Really?
Yeah, and the whole Zen of the way the surfers, big wave surfing and stuff, and the way it's approached. Yeah, and it's something you have to kind of realize is bigger than yourself. You got to be at the right place at the right time. There's a sweet spot. You take what nature has to offer, and you do the run, and you have a certain vortex within that you can be creative. And the best surfers, the really great world-class surfers, there's an element of humility about them. It's a real kind of high comment about improvisation, because once you engage in that wave, once these guys engage in that wave, they're committed. Hey, this is Eric Johnson in the studio for Europe Live.
Eric Johnson had started attracting notices as the guitarist in Austin, Texas jazz fusion band The Electromagnets in the mid-70s. By 1980, Eric Johnson had developed an almost mythical reputation as a spectacular guitarist, enough to garner the cover story of Guitar Player magazine, and that is without a record deal, mind you. This was decades and a half before the internet made it possible for an independent band like Eric Johnson to compete with major labels. In 1980, Eric Johnson's legend as a guitar phenomenon was spreading simply by word of mouth. But it was in 1990 that Eric Johnson broke out of cult hero status among guitar cognoscenti and nabbed those two universally recognized standards of stardom and excellence in contemporary music. Eric sold over 1 million copies of an album and won a Grammy Award with the album Ah Via Musicom. For the first 25 years of his solo career, Eric Johnson was famous, or notorious, for disappearing into the recording studio for multiple years at a time. But since his studio albums Bloom in 2005 and Up Close in 2010, Eric Johnson has had a major musical epiphany, which he shared with us in the studio.
I think the more your concept or your vision is to perform stuff, you know, you can't. I mean, I just heard Change Is Gonna Come by Sam Cooke the other day, and I couldn't, you know, it's like no matter what you do, whether it's an oboe piece or, you know, cajunto music, or, I mean, there's no way you couldn't do it. The best way you could possibly do it is the way Sam Cooke did Change Is Gonna Come. I mean, it can't get, it doesn't, I don't think on this planet it gets any better than that, you know, so why should I, if that's the case, why should I buy into this? No, I can sit in the studio for 6 months and paint it by numbers, and it'll be more brilliant and more colorful and more exacting. And I'm probably right, but will it be as fun to listen to? I don't think so. And I kind of wish I'd figured this out years ago, but I was so seduced by the technology. And that was my own choice. You know, the technology doesn't do it to us. It's our perception that we say, oh, the technology does this. You know, it's our choice whether we use it to, you know, do something, you know, really organic and magnificent, or if we use it to lean on as a crutch, you know, and piece stuff together. But it's a real temptation, and the temptation gets stronger every year, you know. And you listen to records now, and, you know, every single thing is fixed, and every single voice is tuned, and If you take one of those records, as great as it is right now, and there's a lot of great music in today, I think. I mean, there's a lot of great bands. But if you take that and then you listen to that visceral response compared to that, and people get ready, Sam Cooke, you know, it's not like we have to go backwards. It's just like we have a lot to learn from the way they used to make music then when they had no choice.
The slow-phased guitar fireworks on Zenland opened the Live in Europe album by Eric Johnson.
Why is that important, and how did you come to realize the value in spontaneity?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's a big thing for me right now, because I think it's really encapsulate the whole reason anybody would ever do art, you know, is to convey that emotion. And if you're going to convey musical emotion, I think the best immediate, most powerful way you can do it is in a performance. And when you delete the performance or you fragment it, you change the contiguous flow of that energy that would impact somebody. So the information is arriving to them in bits and pieces, and they're kind of having to psychically kind of anneal that those tidbits instead of just feel this contiguous flow. So it's weird. I mean, when I first started playing, we'd just set up and play, and it'd be just this, you know, flow of music, and everybody's excited, and there wasn't any question of doing it any other way. And somehow or another, I got overly seduced by my particular, I'm not going to say it's you have to, I look at it like it was my interpretation that I got overly seduced about, you know, the idea of making Sgt. Pepper or Electric Ladyland, where you disappear in the studio and we have this 16-track machine we can overdub till the cows come home. And I was so blown away with the fact I could sit and I had this 4-track machine at home and I could overdub this part and overdub that part, and I would get in the studio and I'd put on 10 guitars. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with technology. Everything you do, you know, there's two sides to everything. When, you know, we walk, we our right foot goes forward, but our left foot's in the back, or, you know, we switch on a light and the switch is in the, there's like a trade-off for everything, like a duality thing. So everything we gain, there's always some kind of price we pay for it, you know? And so all this gain of being, you know, we can do this, we can do that, but it also if you're not careful, your perception can make you think, it will seduce you into, well, yeah, and we'll put the, okay, now put the D chord on, now put the E chord on. And somehow or another, I got so into that became my strongest muscle, and that's the way I've predominantly made records for most of my life. And you can end up musically making really great records that way, but then you have to ask yourself, well, does it have that contiguous flow, or is it arriving to the listener in a fragmented aural way? And if you really start thinking about that and start listening to music that doesn't do, like old Ray Charles or old Sam Cooke, or, you know, list goes on, Aretha Franklin, or, you know, millions of records that were, they didn't have any choice, they just got in the room and they just played. And there's a certain thing that happens. It's just like, wow, there's no way you can duplicate that. And it started becoming aware to me that it's like, man, you know, don't gain something that has too high of a price. You know, that two-side thing, you paid too high of a price to get this thing. You know, you gain one thing and lose three, you know. And I thought, wow, I need to rethink this, you know. And I'm getting older now, and I want to figure out how to make better music. And I think one of the things is if we jump on board with just trying to perform it. You know, you can still overdub, or you can still fix a note in the studio.
The delightful, breezy, melodic Manhattan first appeared on Eric Johnson's 1996 studio album, Venus Isle, but never better than the performance now found on Europe Live. Next, Eric maintains why purity of intention is equally as important as perseverance. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Eric Johnson for Europe Live.
Hi, this is Eric Johnson in the studio for Europe Live.
Thank you, Eric. I'm Redbeard. And Eric Johnson amplified his notion that perseverance alone, without clarity of intention, can actually make us fixated and stubbornly dogmatic.
This, you know, time-released information happens in your life. You put a question mark out, like, well, you know, maybe I don't have the right answer. Maybe I'm not doing this right. And then, you know, it's like whatever we want, whatever we really want and desire, whatever we dream and put our heart and put our vision, whatever we go for in a wholehearted way, the universe has no choice but to conspire to make it happen. if you put out there, wow, you know, maybe I didn't, if I, no, maybe I haven't been making records the best way I could. Maybe I haven't been performing music the best way I could to make the best music I could. And I don't mean best, you know, less mistakes. That's because I have that kind of reputation that I don't mean faster, louder guitar and less mistakes. I mean more sublime music that touches people's heart. And if I put that question mark out there, I think that there's energy in the universe that conspires to pull us in a way that we're trying to go, if that's what we really want to do, you know? And so a series of time release things happened. I did a European version of Up Close where I re-recorded some of the songs and I cut it live, cut the parts live. And I just noticed that just cutting one track from start to finish live on like a rhythm track on one of the songs made this profound difference in the way the song felt. So then that made me more intrigued. And then, you know, like doing this live record, I started listening to some of the live stuff and some of the soloing I did. I mean, it was like there's little glitches, but I had to be honest with myself. It was more interesting for me to hear some of the aspects of that than it was to listen to my studio records, because it didn't feel as stiff and thought out and you know, clutched and so tightly, you know. It's something that just happened naturally.
Last House on the Block. You really dig into this one. It's pretty much the centerpiece of the album. When did you write Last House on the Block, and what inspired the song?
Bill Maddox and I wrote that tune, and I wrote the music and kind of wrote most of the vocal melody, but Bill wrote the lyrics. And that's a term that people that have had substance abuse use, and that it's like you have to get to the last house on the block and then you get help. So it's kind of a term that I just kind of used from, it might be an AAA term actually, I'm not sure, or it's just a term that Bill used. Bill was a recovering from substance stuff and had been sober for 30 years or so and totally clean and totally, you know, became much better person than he was, you know, just from having gone through that trial by tribulation. But that was just a term he used, and he wrote that song.
When I'm listening to Last House on the Block, I'm thinking this could fit perfectly on Cream's Wheels of Fire, the live side.
Yeah, it's totally what it's coming from. I mean, I'm totally just, I'm sure I'll get sued by Eric Clapton at some point because that record is completely ripped off every lick. But
no.
It came from when I was a kid. And I used to sit there and play. And in particularly the Wheels of Fire record, because it had these long songs forever. And I would just sit there and jam along with that forever. It was a period of 2 years where I was just that 90% everything I listened to was Cream.
The blazing instrumental Zap from Eric Johnson's impressive major label debut, Tones, in 1986, left the European audiences breathless. But Eric Johnson has never had fame or wealth as his goals. What do you think the role of music is?
I think anything that opens up your heart or gives you an elevated sense of well-being that's on more of a, you know, a consciousness to where you have compassion for others and yourself as well, and you realize the power of forgiveness and kind of operating on that kind of frequency. Anything that gets you there, you know, you could be a poet and that's inspired by somebody else, or that makes you write a poem that further commits you to trying to stay on the balance or surfing that frequency, you know, anything it is. I don't think it can be just music, obviously, but for me, I mean, it's a way of saying words through music that sometimes I can say better than if I'm just thinking out loud or something. So I think we have to come to the realization that there's no thing we do here that's going to,
transcend
or put us on that frequency. You know, what's going to get us there is our heart and our thoughts and our feelings and our opening up to that other place that can, you know, kind of bathe us and take us somewhere, you know. And I don't whether we serve food at a restaurant or we, you know, are president of a country, it's not gonna be the way we do it, and we're not going to get any thing from that. You know, we can choose either, and they're all both good and they're both wonderful, and But I don't think they're going to, that's not, I don't think that me playing music is going to get me there, but maybe some of the words or notes, you know, will help me live in that space or, you know, think about it more, and then I can do the other work, I guess.
Eric Johnson, guitar pyrotechnics, framing an important message echoed by his fellow Texas friend Stevie Ray Vaughan and the late Doyle Bramall on songs like Life by the Drop, among others. That's Last House on the Block from Eric Johnson's Europe Live. Still to come, Eric looks back to his game changer, Avia Musicom. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and more unreleased live performances from Eric at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Eric Johnson for Europe Live.
Hi, this is Eric Johnson in the studio for Europe Live.
And I'm Redbeard. 1990 was a life-altering year in Eric Johnson's career when his album Avia Musicom spawned three U.S. rock radio hits, including the song Cliffs of Dover, which would go on to win a Grammy Award for Eric Johnson in 1992, all the while the album eventually selling over 1 million copies.
Will you assess the significance of that project in your career?
It changed everything for me, really, as far as having a prolonged career and being able to support myself and other people and stuff. It was a lucky break. I think it was a good. I've worked really hard on that record to try to push myself to the limit of what I could do. My health was horrible after I finished that record because I worked so hard.
Really?
It took me 6 months to regain my, you know, I was completely emotionally and physically trashed.
Wow.
I think I just recorded, you know, that song. The whole record, you know, I would record it and then I'd redo it because I was going for, you know, a certain performance level and a certain sound, you know. But I'm glad I did that, and then it kind of set a precedent for me to keep going forward. There was a guy named Jeffrey Shane at Capitol at the time, because I
know Jeff.
Yeah, and when I put out Avia Musicom, it was like I couldn't get arrested, really. And he just came to me one day there and went, you know, this is a really nice record. I don't care what anybody says. I'm going to make this record happen because I like it. And I think sometimes we just get lucky if somebody has conviction and believes in what we do, and they just get out and they go to bat for you, and they have such a conviction that it's infectious, and other people feel that. I remember we were having a discussion, some friends and I, about, well, if you're a great salesman, you can sell a vacuum cleaner to anybody, and it doesn't matter what you think about it. And I remember kind of being of the opinion, no, I don't agree with that. You can be a great salesman, you can sell vacuum cleaners, but if you knock on that door and you're like, man, if you have the conviction that you know and you feel that you really like this thing, then I think it puts it in a different octave, you know, with the seller, the buyer, you know. And I think I was lucky that Jeff just resonated with it, because he went around and he just convinced people, and then at least gave it the time of day to give it a chance, you know. And there's a lot of great music out there that never gets an opportunity. It might not have somebody champion it or somebody, you know, with conviction. I mean, you know, it's like when Loretta Lynn made, I remember reading a story about when she made her first records, and everybody's like, oh, please leave us alone. And I think it was her husband at the time, or guy had Phil, he said, I don't care what anybody said. He filled the whole trunk with her records and he drove everywhere. What would have happened to her if that hadn't happened, you know? Never. And sometimes we just need that one person that resonates and just goes, wow, I get it, you know. And then they make it a mission to go out and convince people to get it, you know, and or to understand. So,
well, yeah. And that's really neat that you name dropped Jeff Shane. I need to find him. I haven't talked to him in years. He did me a huge solid in my career as well, so that just makes me think. Sounds to me like I need to find him.
Yeah, well, if you do, tell him hello for me.
I'll play the things that you just said. Will make his millennium.
Yeah. Well, I owe him a lot of thanks for making that, because it was, you got to kind of laugh at the way this whole planet is. I mean, one minute you walk in one place and it's like, oh no, please, will you enter on your hands and knees and use this dog bowl over there? And then 2 weeks later you go in and they're like, oh, can I get you a tea from Madagascar? And here's your silver slippers. I mean, you just got to laugh, you know, because what's your other choice? Or what's your other, you know, you could like get brittle and freak out and, you know, oh, no, wow, you know what I mean? And then you just break in half. Who cares? And at the end of the day, who cares? Who, it doesn't, because it doesn't matter either way. It's kind of not, it doesn't mean anything. So, so the best, I just kind of laugh about it at this point. And you watch that up and down thing, you know, 1 minute somebody's putting a crown on you, and the next minute you're getting the boot in your rear end, you know. So, you know, and especially in this business, you know,
especially
record people, business. The musicians, oh. And the, everybody, you know, we're all, sure. It's just like, wow.
Awarded in 1992 as the Grammy Instrumental of the Year, Cliffs of Dover by Eric Johnson is now a part of Europe Live, in stores and online now.
Why did you specifically thank God first in the credits on Europe Live?
I think it's just that, you know, whatever you want to call that field intelligence or that force or that thread, that silver light, a thread between us all, you know, and before and beyond us. And I think it's as strong as we can allow ourselves to open up and realize that it's there. I have a feeling that, like, when we leave this planet, that we're going to just say something like, I had no idea. I didn't know.
I'm with you, big time.
I couldn't know. It's almost like if we were being like, if we were like floating above Grand Canyon for 80 years, you know, with like a mile of space below us, you know, and we spent our whole life and we're kind of like dancing around going, yeah, everything's fine. And at the end of our life, we go, wow, that whole time we had this incredible hand holding us up the whole time. And I was just like, I didn't know. I just didn't know, you know. But I think there are little glimmers that we could know if we open up a little and we can feel a little. I'm not sure why the shroud or the wizard behind the curtain. It's all a mystery to me. And the more you delve into it, the deeper the mystery gets. It's because we're trying to use our mind and our English language to figure out something that, you know what I mean? But so it's almost like, I think you just go, wow, there's something, you know, and people want to, you know, call it different entities and dissect it all up and say, I created that, and then go to their corner of the room and you know, say they have a reason to, you know, kill other people over it. You know, it's a sickness, really, and it's sad. But, you know, if you get back to that beginning, you know, it's like we're all the same. Like you said, we all have the same needs. We all have the same wants. We all looking for the same thing. We all have that same silver light of thread, you know. And so I'm thankful that I can be part of it. But I'm thankful that at least one of my eyes is half open, you know, and I'm a little bit jolted in my seat. I'm a little bit kind of twitching in my slumber, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Instead of just like sleeping through the whole thing and, you know, missing the whole boat, at least I think I hear something, or I think I see something, you know, I'm sort of awake a little bit, you know.
Why do you insist on performing as a trio live?
Well, it's sometimes easier to tour that way. I've actually recently thought I'd like to maybe add a fourth member, and we just did a show where I had a keyboard player come out and play with us, and it was great. It was tons of fun. I'd like to do more of that. But I don't know, over the years, it's just, I've enjoyed the freedom of the three-piece, but I'm also kind of interested. I'm getting more interested in recording live music, whether it's in the studio or on stage, and consequently, if it's going to be live in the studio, I think it might be cool to try more members.
Since I don't play, and since this is going to a mass appeal audience rather than just, an audience of just musicians, could you expand on, you said that the trio format gives you more freedom. In what way? It seems to me that there are obvious limitations to staying true to the trio format. What are the benefits?
Yeah, the limitations, obviously, you know, you just don't have as much interesting textures, and it's hard to pull off the music you do in the studio if you've done a lot of overdubs. Absolutely. The benefits are like in the improvisation sections. You have a dialogue between three people, and you have more room to go anywhere you want to go harmonically, because there's not as much being kind of colored in a certain way, you know, harmonically. If you have another member, then he's doing his own set of harmonics, which will then kind of somewhat confine you into that realm. Whereas in a trio, it's just wide open pretty much, except for the bass player. But that leaves a lot. It's just more room to more real estate to roam around in, kind of.
But being I'm going to play devil's advocate. From what I've been told by people that perform in the trio configuration, there's no place to hide.
No, there really isn't. And it's tough, really. It depends on if you write your music for it. If you construct your music for it, it can work pretty well. It's kind of an irony, because I feel that I construct my music more for a bigger band, yet I go out and play trio. So there's sometimes a real disparity in my live shows. They might have more. They have maybe more energy, more spontaneity, and more kind of that immediate kind of feeling you get from it. Which really, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing of all. So, but they'll be missing some of the parts. So it's a real trade-off. And yeah, I just think you have to kind of look at the kind of music you make. And in total honesty, I think, well, the kind of music I make really isn't completely three-piece music, so it would probably be better if I did have a bigger band live.
Prior to the Tones album, and long before the internet, how did people outside of America discover you and your music in Europe?
I think there was very few people that had really heard of it, and because I don't think the Tones, I didn't really have any product outed, but I'm not really sure. I think it was mainly just getting the opportunity to play with Carol and Cat Stevens, and then doing some session work probably helped a little bit, being on that. And I guess, some of that stuff and some demo tapes probably floated over there a little bit, but nobody really knew much of what I was doing or anything.
Were the guitar magazines, and were the guitar magazines then as powerful a networking tool as they are in the States back?
I think they were, and that probably actually had a lot to do with it and helped me out a lot, because Steve Morse kind of introduced me to Guitar Player magazine, and they did an article on me, which really helped me start getting gigs and stuff. And then we ended up doing several articles with that magazine, and things just kind of picked up a little bit.
When did you most recently perform in Europe, and how have European perceptions of Americans changed from your first visits there to now?
We were there last October. In fact, I think a lot of this record was done then, the one we're putting out right now. And I don't know. I feel like there's a more of a global kind of thing now. There's less boundaries with everybody. Everybody seems to be a little, share a lot of the same ideals and stuff. And I guess, with the internet and everything, I mean, everybody's like privy to the same kind of information and stuff, so there seems to be more of a global feel to me.
Do you think that that's actually changed, or just our realization that people in other places have the same wants and needs that Americans do?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, and that's the feeling I get no matter where we go, whether it's Malaysia or China or South America, anywhere I've ever been, it to me it's almost like it's a serious situation, but it's almost, you almost gotta kind of chuckle about it. I mean, the fact that we draw such distinction is amazing, because everybody really is the same. Everybody has the same needs, everybody has the same wants, the same dreams, and we emphasize the differences so much. But that's the feeling I get when I go play places, that, you know, the differences we emphasize are so much smaller than the common, you know, threads between us all. And once you kind of get into, you get that vibe and you feel that kind of emotion from people, you know, the rest of it just kind of melts away and disappears. So it does become more like, you know, you're just playing anywhere. Other than the fact that certain places people are maybe extra appreciative because you made the effort to come over there, you know, when you go.
Really? Now that's interesting. Can you expand?
Oh, I was blown away. I mean, I played in Mexico and in South America, and they're just so warm and so, you can just feel it. I mean, and it's not necessarily me. I mean, it could be any band that you know, that's decent, that makes the effort to go somewhere and play for people that it's not completely easy to just be there, you know, because you're from another side of the world, and there's a real appreciation of that. I really felt that in Mexico. The people were so beautiful and warm and friendly and smiling and just thankful that you would take the time and the effort to do that.
Cool. Any material or approach live that you include in, let's say, a European setting that might make more sense there than stateside?
Well, I feel like there's not the same pressure or need to play just the songs you've had success with. You can, as long as you're delving into something that's, you know, musically interesting and has depth to it, I think. Sometimes audiences will be a little bit more open to accepting it.
Okay. Since your last album release, Joe Bonamassa in particular released a series of popular live performances, specifically from the UK and on the continent, and it startled a lot of industry watchers. Have you had an opportunity to discuss that with Joe B? And to what do you attribute that phenomenon?
Well, I think Joe's a good example of someone that's kind of put all the pieces together correctly. I mean, he's a guitar gunslinger, I guess, which is a kind of crazy title. But I mean, he's one of the guitar guys, and so that in and of itself will kind of pigeonhole you into a certain place. But what Joe has done is he's put together a great show, and he plays some of his repertoire is made up of songs that people can really, you know, that they know, and then he reworks them and rearranges them. And I think most importantly, I think those are important things, that he has a great show, he's a good showman, and he's an excellent guitar player. But I think most importantly, he's a really, really good singer too. So he has a package kind of like Stevie Ray would have, where, you know, you've got the singing, you've got the great plan, and you can come out and deliver a show. So I think he sometimes would be an exception to the rule, I think, as far as appealing to a large audience. He's done his homework on what it takes to put that whole recipe together. It's significantly more than just being a really good guitarist, I think.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because yeah. I agree with you. Yeah. Our mutual friend, guitarist Andy Timmons, told me years ago that he and Simon Phillips could tour successfully in Europe and Japan practically every year, yet Andy's still largely undiscovered here in his own country. What are the factors that make that the case, and do you yourself face any of the same career challenges?
Well, I think, you know, kind of what you were touching on, I think a lot of the European audiences, their ABCs of why they'll go see you, or what have you done to, you know, they just want to hear good music, and they want to see somebody, you know, soulfully play, and it's something, and that's really their criteria, and they're much more they're not as interested in all the little ABCs of, you know, oh well, he had this hit song last year, or he's done this or that, you know what I mean? It's like it's a little bit more of a Well, you know, if it's good musically, we're more open, a little bit more open-minded in certain ways. So I think that good musicians such as Andy sometimes will have an easier time in Europe. And then the fact that he goes back and back and back, the European audiences seem to be really loyal. If you can deliver good music, they're loyal to come back and hear you. So it would make sense to me. And then, you know, coming to America, it's almost like, well, what records have you done, or what songs have been, you know, at some point in your career been on the radio or whatever. So I think the criteria might be a little harder in certain ways. But then somebody like me, it's almost easier for me to play in the States than in Europe right now. But that's largely just because I have not toured a lot over there. You know, I've only done a handful of tours there, whereas if I had gone back and back and back, it would probably be easier.
This is Red Beard in the studio, thanking my guest Eric Johnson, manager Joe Priestman, and Sweet Lorraine with Pro Vogue Music. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Theme song by Andy Timmons, a friend of Eric Johnson. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. And you can find a lot more by the biggest names at rock when you visit inthestudio.net.